Tuesday, August 2nd, was the day that had caused Bess and me to flinch when we first heard about it. A state dinner planned for the week of the wedding? Yes. President Shazar of Israel and Mrs. Shazar. Let's just say it was a challenge. And it turned out quite happily, as exhausted as everybody must have been at the end of the day. Isabel Shelton's description, the White House was a madhouse yesterday, was actually pretty accurate. The last of the bridesmaids, Beth Jenkins, arrived, and I hurried to find her in the lovely blue toile bedroom to give her a hug. The young man she's going to marry, Peter Allant, had come up too to plan their day. And then I stopped by the solarium, which has suddenly turned into an office, with Susan Ray as head of the brigade. The bridesmaids, as many of the 12 as she can gather, are attacking the flood of letters, nearly 1,000 a week, that Lucy has been receiving. They're opening them, reading them, stapling them, and sorting them into 4 different piles for later answering. They keep on finding some that are so dear, so delightful, they think they ought to have special answers. So I gave Susan another chore, told her there was plenty of the blue stationery with Lucy's name on top, which will not much longer be her name, and the White House on the envelope, which will no longer be her address. And I'd just love for her to answer as many as she could at Lucy's request. It was Warren Lynn's birthday, and so I wrapped a package of the bridge cards that Lyndon gives and wished that sweetest of our friends a happy day. She's at Linda's side every minute. She's conscious of the special meaning of this week for Linda. She is a good friend. Down in the kitchen, Ferdinand and 2 assistants were pulling taffy, so to speak, making the sugar concoction will turn into the roses to decorate Lucy's 7-layer wedding cake. Meanwhile, a delivery truck rolled up, bearing a huge piano for Mr. Serkin to play that night, and in it came through the halls. He always brings his own instrument. Later, I understand, he had a quiet practice period on the stage. Maybe he was the only quiet man in the house. We were directing tours of Mrs. Nugent's friends and family through, because there won't be much chance later in the week to do so. And in the library, in the afternoon, Lucy and Pat were giving a filmed interview to 3 television networks, with Nancy Dickerson asking the questions for NBC. My heart went out to her. She had just received word some hours before that her daddy had died, and she was leaving right after the interview. I remembered Dolly's statement, "Shock carries its own anesthesia," and Nancy is a professional. And Bess, the always calm, was taking Mrs. Nugent out to the shrine to decide how it would be best for her to manage the long walk. She is an amputee. She never mentions it. One scarcely notices it. But it does limit her ability to negotiate those vast steps and long aisle. So it was a busy day. Sometime in the morning, I went down to see Willie Day in her lair and saw the most wonderful gift from the Englehearts, a Winslow Homer drawing of the apple picker. Small, charming. I do not know the medium, but touched somehow with a little color. A perfect jewel. And most amazingly, there was a very old figure of the Virgin and Child from Abe and Carol. I found later it had been made by Austrian nuns almost a century ago, with the tiniest detail perfect. Embroidered garments, tiny beads, the most exquisite expressions. An antique cake basket from Van Cliburn, an Onderdok drawing from Nancy Negley. I stopped by the corridor outside the theater to see the display of White House brides that Jim Ketchum has just finished. From Maria Monroe through the niece of President Woodrow Wilson, who'd married Isaac Stewart McElroy and who had sent us the cake box and the brooch that she wore at the wedding. It was a delightful display, but it kept on saying to me, "Save, save. Remember to leave to the White House, to the Johnson Library, for the Smithsonian if it wants it, and very especially to Lucy and to us." Interesting things from this wedding. There was so little, really. A picture of 8 brides, 1 invitation, an autographed place card from Woodrow Wilson, done in pencil. I stopped by the kitchen to see what I could find for lunch. Zephyr said they'd fed 19. There wasn't a bit of cold beef left, so I settled for bacon and eggs again. I phoned Lawrence Rockefeller to thank him for his wonderful offer of the visit to the Grand Tetons, of the Virgin Islands, and of other help on getting the children off on their honeymoon. He left it open-end, that invitation, and how much I hope I can take it up some other time. And then, the very nicest moment of the day came. Lyndon called and said, could you find Lucy and Pat and bring them over to the office? Find me wherever I am. I need some cheering up, and I want to give them their wedding present. I rounded them up. We went. He was in his office. He bought a government bond, which would mature in 7 years, and on the envelope there was a very sweet message. He had written it, to our children, who bring us so much joy and strength. That is the way I remember it. If one can be sure of anything in this world, it is that those two will have need of something special 7 years from now. A just perfect desk to put in the bay window of a house they may be building. An antique chest to lend character to their living room. Or maybe a vacation. I was strangely gratified that Lucy herself had told me days before that that is what she would like most to have as a government bond, and the reason why is she remembered that when we first married, we had started buying one each month and had kept it up for years and years. You sow seeds, you never know whether they strike fertile ground and bear fruit. It's always a pleasant surprise when they do. Jean-Louis came over about 6:30, and from then on, it was a round of hair combing and dressing for the state dinner. I wore my most elegant dress, the printed chiffon, and at 8:20, I was madly phoning Lyndon's office to get him over to get dressed so we could meet the president on the front portico at 8:10. He is the swiftest dresser in all the world. He could have done it if he hadn't gotten hung up on the telephone, but we were down just a few minutes late, exactly at the moment with the big black limousine fluttering the flags of the United States and the Star of David drove up, and out stepped the elderly, affable, big-domed President Chazar and his equally elderly, soft-spoken, but I believe strong-minded wife, Rachel Chazar. We took them up to the Yellow Room with their ambassador and Mrs. Harmon, three members of their party, the Vice President and Muriel, and Dean in Virginia, and Dorothy Goldberg, four ambassadors out of the country, and the Fortises, and our ambassador, Mr. Barber, already waited for us. There was drinks, conversation, and exchange of gifts. And here I find myself inept at being able to move people like images on a chessboard, particularly when they are 77 years old and probably a bit deaf. There is an aggressiveness cloaked in velvet that I wish I could cultivate. I was really enjoying hearing Mrs. Chazar talk in her very quiet voice about the speech she had made to a luncheon group, about education of the very young in Israel, actually about the making of Israel into a nation, a considerable accent on beautification. But my relaxed enjoyment couldn't be wholehearted because I must move them over toward the desk and show them our gifts, the set of the works of Thomas Jefferson in a special bookcase, art books for Mrs. Chazar, picture of Lyndon in a silver frame, a little silver box from me. I am not yet satisfied with our gifts. Although President Chazar was quick to say he knew the works of Thomas Jefferson, they'd been translated into his language. And then we saw theirs. Modern silver candlesticks for Lucy and Pat, gold, silver, and bronze medallions, which commemorated the visit of Pope Paul VI to Israel, and very wonderful medallions that told the history of their nation. On one side, the ancient Israel, the biblical inscription. On the other side, the modern Israel, the implements of agriculture and industry. Then there was a great Bible, all in Hebrew, ponderous, handsome, an item for the library. I was a bit thrown when the military entered and removed the colors, because that is always a signal for us to line up and follow them downstairs for the official picture. Not so. Jimmy Symington shook his head at me, and I realized that because of their age, we would not be marching down those slick marble stairs. We would instead be going down in the elevator with them a few minutes later, and we did, crossing the hall to assume our usual pose at the foot of the grand staircase for the battery of photographers. Then to hail to the chief never fails to strike that high note of excitement in your heart. We marched into the East Room to what was undoubtedly the longest, slowest receiving line for any state dinner I can remember 190 guests, many of whom wanted to see a great deal besides Shalom. They'd been to Israel. They had this or that tie with Israel. Because the stage was already occupying one-third of the room, the guests were rather crowded in a double line in the remaining two-thirds that lacked a bit of elegance and precision I love to keep in these affairs. From the cabinet, there were Joe and Trudy Fowler, and Lee and Stu Udall with the most marvelous tans from their vacation, and every senator with any Jewish blood. Senator Javits, whose wife had just written that Washington is a provincial town, Senator and Mrs. Ribicoff, and Maureen Newberger, with her husband, Dr. Philip Solomon. It may be her last time here for a state dinner. And among others, Senator Hickenlooper without Verna, and Senator and Mrs. Carl Munt. I observed that the Robert Kennedys declined. Mrs. Kennedy is away. There were two governors, Richard Hughes of New Jersey, and his wonderful, ebullient wife, and the Nelson Rockefellers, a more attractive group of brothers I never saw. Happy had on one of the most striking dresses of the evening, a white and red printed chiffon, and an enormous group of House members, including, I believe, all of the Jews, and Averill and Marie Harriman, who amusingly described the difficulties of anybody introducing him and the ambassador from Israel at the same time, Mr. Avram Harmon and Mr. Averill Harriman, and Dorothy and Leonard Marks, and from the staff, Walt Rostow, and Marvin, very seldom do he and his pretty Marion accept anything. And the Milt Seamers, and the Bob Flemings, I'm glad to see him sometime. That is not a stressful occasion. If one really wants to know how much of a melting pot this country is, a state dinner is an interesting way. There are always ethnic groups. There are always organizations representing the interests of these groups, and one comes to realize how multitudinous are those organizations. The American Jewish Committee, the Synagogue Council of America, the Development Corporation for Israel, that was Abe Feinberg, United Israel Appeal, and the United Jewish Appeal. From Labor, there was that bouncing pixie, David Dubinsky, whispered to me that he thought everything was going fine, and Jacob Potofsky, whom last I had seen standing at the foot of the Statue of Liberty, almost with tears in his eyes, on the day of the signing of the bill, and Alex Rose, who paused in the line to get across some point.